This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Brian Hughes. This week, I'll be speaking with David Parmalee and Claire Jolie from Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre about their upcoming production of The Pillow Man. We'll also feature an encore of my interview with Dr. Kenneth Thorpe about weight loss and how it can save on your health care plan. Nancy and Jason from the WLK Morning News speak with Bob Durkin from the Greater Scranton Chamber of Commerce about the local business community update. And I'll feature an encore of my interview with Brant Pfeiffer about National Dog Training Month, which is the month of January, and how best to train your dog. Special Edition gets started right now. This is Special Edition. I'm Brian Hughes. Guests in the studio, David Parmalee and Claire Joelle, marketing director from Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre. Finally got to see you. I get your emails all the time, and I've never gotten to see you. I was wondering if you were ever going to come down and pay us a visit.
We meet in person.
We do indeed. Here to talk about what else, a play. It's called The Pillow Man, and it opens up January 31st, runs through February 9th at Little Theater in Wilkes-Barre. Now, I know the other plays that you guys came down to promote. You had Jersey Boys, you had the Rocky Horror Show, and there was that radio play thing, It's a Wonderful Life, which sounded really, it was great, but tell us about The Pillow Man.
Well, The Pillow Man is by far the darkest production that we have done at Little Theater. It was written by Martin McDonagh back in the 90s. It has met with critical acclaim, but viewer discretion is advised.
Good to know.
It is about a writer in a totalitarian police state who writes stories about children. But then he is brought in for questioning by the police when his stories, or when real life crimes begin to imitate his stories. So that is the top down overview of the play, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Okay.
Yes, there is.
David, you want to fill in a few blanks?
You know, in the wintertime, we take a turn at Little Theater in a little different direction. Musicals are as fun as it gets, right? Everybody loves a good upbeat musical.
Sure.
Like you mentioned, Jersey Boys.
Yep.
We did a High School Musical last year. But there's so much drama that it is truly worthwhile, that the fans of a good stage play will appreciate. And we have a slot on our schedule for that. In the spring, we do a comedy. In the winter, we do what I nicknamed years ago, the Winter Heavy.
Okay.
And 2 years ago, we did Dracula. That's the sort of heaviness.
I hear you. So it looks like we're in for a heavy winter. Is
exactly.
That's kind of what you're warning us about?
But this is very modern.
Yeah.
It's a play that will make you think. Very dark, as Claire said. It's a psychological drama. And boy, do you go through a roller coaster of emotions when you attend. It's outstanding theater. And that's what we like to do.
Okay,
course,
I can see
not
that.
Not for everybody.
Right.
But there isn't anything that is for everybody.
Very true.
This is for people who appreciate an evening of excellent theater that'll make them think.
Okay. Was this a book or was this like a straight play? Because I was trying to figure out where it came from, because I had never heard of the Pillow Man before.
So it was written as a play initially. And there are some people who say that Martin McDonagh has actually written the short stories that were used for inspiration in the play, but he's never confirmed that. So just a play.
Just a play. This is Special Edition. Guest in the studio, Claire Joelle, marketing director, and David Parmalee from Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre talking about a play, Martin McDonagh's The Pillow Man. It's happening January 31st through February 9th at Little Theater, 537 North Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. So whose idea was it to bring this play in, The Pillow Man?
We did a lot of research as a committee.
Okay.
In the season selection. And, you know, some of the most popular dramas on television are police stories.
Right.
Forensics, that sort of thing, CSI. And we thought we had such success with Dracula. Let's go in that direction. Not gothic horror, which Dracula is, but something very modern that talks about police, about right. the responsibility of creative people solving crimes. And, you know, it goes down so deeply into the issue of who do we trust? Do you trust the police? Do you trust the media? What are the responsibilities of us as we try to take care of each other and prevent bad things from happening? And that's the theme of so much film and television. So we thought that this is the time to do this. Yeah. These issues come up.
I'm going to say, when I think of like Law and Order shows like that, maybe Law and Order the musical? We give that a shot?
It would be a great parody.
I think it would be. I think it would. Maybe save that for the lighter stuff, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I always thought the only thing that could end Law and Order would be a newspaper strike, because everything used to be ripped out of the headlines.
Ripped from today's headlines, exactly.
Now, the first time I looked at the description for the Pillow Man, about somebody going on trial, it kind of reminded me a little bit of the Kafka movie, The Trial, which was based in a dystopian landscape. I believe Orson Welles was in it and Anthony Perkins many, many years ago.
Oh, that's a great reference. In fact, there's connections, I think, to a lot of well-known classic pieces. Certainly 1984 by Orwell, which comes up constantly as people analyze the news. And a classic film going back to, I think, about 1970, Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah.
The Anthony Burgess story.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. So once again, talking about The Pillow Man by Martin McDonagh, coming up January 31st through February 9th, the Little Theater in Wilkes-Barre. They're at 537 North Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. Tell me about the times and a little bit more maybe about the play itself.
So the one thing I really do want to get across is that I want our audiences to know what they are in for when they come to The Pillow Man. There is offensive language. There is depictions of violence on stage. There is mention of child abuse, murder, suicide. When we say dark, we mean dark.
Okay.
So
we're talking pitch black, not like varying shades of gray here.
Oh, you know that black that like removes all light from the room?
Okay.
That's how dark this one is. But like David said, it is an excellent piece of theater. I've been working with this cast for the past month now, and they astound me every single day. It is just, it's incredible. Every rehearsal, they get better. It's really remarkable.
It's an outstanding cast. Truly exceptional. Yep.
Now, did this ever end up on Broadway by any chance? Or is it, like I said, I just draw a total blank, because usually some of the other shows that you've done, I would have heard of. But The Pillow Man, you know, that's why I'm asking all the questions.
So it was initially performed in the UK, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know it's been done locally in the United States. I don't know if it's been done on Broadway. I don't think so.
So this might be a Northeast PA debut then.
It's not, unfortunately.
Nope. Well, we'll
thought
get them
we
next
had
time.
It, but we didn't.
All right.
The British or UK version of Broadway would be the West End, and it has played there.
Yes.
It's an Irish author. But what a great piece. I feel like the theme parks that have famous roller coasters, and people flock to those theme parks. But at every one of those, there's that sign, you know, are you tall enough to ride the ride? Like, are you ready to get
you're going to have little signs out front? Are you tall enough to experience the Pillow Man?
And then once you start with this, it's going to take you on quite a ride.
It gets you into an emotional chokehold and does not let up the entire performance.
Of course, the other thing I thought of when I first heard of the Pillow Man was Mike Lindell, the My Pillow guy. It's nothing to do with him.
No.
This is Special Edition. I'm giving you some ideas for future plays here. Guest is Claire Joelle, Marketing Director, and, of course, David Parmalee from Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre, talking about the play The Pillow Man. It's going to be an interesting experience, I'm sure. And if you're talking about rides, maybe that could be, you can bring this up with Knoebels and just say, hey, you think the Phoenix is rough? You should try The Pillow Man.
Exactly. Part of our mission at Little Theater is to do excellent theater that's affordable for our friends and neighbors. If we can't make it accessible to people,
right?
Why do it? So this is a $20 ticket. We have our Legacy Bar open. Again, very affordable.
Right.
We have performances on Friday and Saturday evenings at 8 and matinees on Sundays at 3 for people who prefer that time slot. And three parking lots.
Three parking lot. You can't beat that.
Downtown, but easy parking.
Excellent. You might need a stiff belt after experiencing the Pillow Man, I would think. Tell me more the times, dates of the Pillow Man. That's it's coming up later this month, I understand.
Yes. We open in about a week and a half, Friday, January 31st. And we run through February 9th. So as David said, it's Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m.
Interesting question on this release. What price must we pay for the stories we tell? That's a very interesting little piece. Once again, talking about The Pillow Man, played by Martin McDonagh. It premiered, I guess, in London, West End, and played there. Don't know if it ever played Broadway, but it's played here somewhere before, and it's going to play again January 31st through February 9th. Anything else you'd like to tell us about either The Pillow Man or maybe a sneak preview of anything coming up later in 2025?
Well, if you have not been to Little Theater, or if you haven't been there in a while, please join us. You're going to be surprised at the magic of that wonderful old 1940 building. Been operating as a theater since 1956.
Wow.
And we're in our 103rd season. And it truly is an experience that sort of takes you back in time to old Wilkes-Barre. It is a great place to see an excellent show. Now, coming up after this, we go back to our musicals. And one of the most popular musicals of all time, and I still have the original cast album from 1970, Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, okay.
So that's next on the schedule.
So I'm guessing maybe around Easter time or a little slightly thereafter?
Not far away.
Okay.
Yeah, that worked out.
Excellent. So we got a sneak preview of Jesus Christ Superstar coming to Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre. But talking about The Pillow Man, David, Claire, appreciate you both coming in and joining us here on Special Edition. Best of luck with the play.
Thanks. And Brian, thank you for helping us tell our story. We appreciate it very much.
This is Special Edition. I'm Brian Hughes. My guest is Dr. Kenneth Thorpe, chairman of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, here to talk about a new analysis showing that weight loss saves employers and Medicaid healthcare costs. That seems like it makes sense. Good morning, doctor.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us some of the things we could also learn from this particular study.
Well, I think several things. One is that we wanted to quantify the reduction in healthcare spending associated with lower weight, lower body mass index. And we did look at Medicare and patients with private health insurance. And what we found is that for people that lose up to 25% of their body mass, which is well within the range that we're seeing now with these well-advertised GLP-1 medications and lifestyle interventions, that you can save up to 30 to 35% on healthcare spending, spend 30 to 35% less on healthcare than if you don't have weight loss. So the potential economic and healthcare benefits are enormous. We also know that the health benefits are enormous. You're less likely to have a stroke, a heart attack, a blood sugar buildup that could be damaging. So it's just not only good financially, but it's also obviously good for your health.
Now, I think a couple of the drugs you're referring to are Wegovy and Ozempic, I'm assuming.
That's correct. Yeah, Ozempic, Wegovy, or Mounjaro. There's a variety of ones that are very similar, but they're currently approved to treat different conditions like Ozempic with diabetes and Wegovy a little bit more broader. But they basically work very similarly, but they're generating really important results. So there was a study that just came out yesterday that the Veterans Administration did, looking at the impact of these GLP-1 medications on a whole variety of chronic healthcare conditions, including Alzheimer's. So what they're finding is that it has broader impacts on cardiovascular health, potentially even on Alzheimer's and dementia. So we're just at the cusp of learning how these medications are working. But certainly, just simply focusing on the cost of administering the drug is missing the bigger picture. It has a big reductions in healthcare spending, it has broader health implications that we're just trying to get a handle on.
That's pretty amazing news, because we're talking about all these different conditions kind of like all coming together. And if just weight loss alone you're looking for, there are other side benefits as well. And that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you're going to see is it's going to reduce the number of new cases of patients that have heart disease, that have type 2 diabetes, that have high blood pressure and elevated cholesterol. So, I mean, the health effects going forward, we're just getting a handle on and trying to quantify and understand. But that VA study that I just mentioned that was published yesterday looked at the impact of weight loss and the medications on about 175 different conditions.
Pretty amazing. This is Special Edition. My guest is Dr. Kenneth Thorpe, chairman of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, talking about a new analysis showing weight loss saves employers and Medicare health care costs. And, you know, that's the thing with health insurance. Seems like it's always going up. And, yeah, any way you can save on that is good news indeed. In 2023, obesity cost employers and employees $400 billion. That's a pretty big number, given the U.S. isn't an aging population.
No, that's true. And certainly, if you want to slow the growth in your health insurance premiums and to focus now with the new administration on Medicare, chronic disease is the number one cause of the high level and growth in healthcare spending. So we need to find ways to reduce the prevalence and more effectively manage chronic disease. And certainly weight loss is kind of at the core of doing that.
Now, the trick is you can't just depend on particular drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic to be like a magic pill that's going to cure everything. We still have to add diet and exercise to the equation in order to make it truly work.
Absolutely. You have to couple it with lifestyle change to make it sustainable over time. And fortunately, in the Medicare program, they have a well-established, very effective program called the Diabetes Prevention Program, which has been shown to reduce the number of new cases of type 2 diabetes. It generates weight loss. And it couples sort of counseling on diet, exercise, and nutrition. It has physical activity goals built into it. It's a program that works. Many employers provide coverage for that program too, or something similar. So to the extent we can make that program better known and used more frequently, that's going to make sure that these savings in healthcare spending related to weight loss are sustained over time.
And just for individuals with employer-sponsored insurance, a 5% weight loss reduced healthcare spending by $670, or 8% per person annually. 25% weight loss reduced spending by more than $2,800. So those are pretty big numbers. They add up at the end.
They certainly do. Yeah. That's almost a third of what the spending is today compared to what would happen if we had people who are overweight and obese lose about 25% of their body mass. So the savings are real. The chronic disease expenditures go down. The number of new cases of chronic illness are fewer. So the health effects are substantial. It doesn't even include the impact it has on increased worker productivity, reduced absenteeism from work. So the benefits are really widespread, and we just wanted to quantify them.
It sounds like a pretty big number. We're talking about losing 25% of your body weight. But given what's at stake, namely better health and savings on healthcare costs, it definitely sounds like it's worth the effort.
Absolutely. And then we've seen from published the randomized controlled trials on these weight loss medications, as well as the lifestyle interventions, that roughly a third of people who are overweight and obese lose over 20% of their body mass. So it's well within the data. It's doable. And I think we just need to find ways to obviously get the underlying drug price costs down, which they will decline because manufacturing is increasing and there's more competition. But at the same time, we've got to focus on the benefits, not just the cost of the interventions, but highlighting the benefits, I think, are important in terms of individuals' health and what employers and Medicare spend on healthcare on healthcare costs.
Dr. Thorpe, where can we find out more information about this analysis, how weight loss saves employers and Medicare healthcare costs, and eventually, if you have a plan through work, will save you money as well?
Well, sure. There's two places you can look. One is that the study was published December 5th in JAMA, J-A-M-A, Health Forum. So it's online, available for people to download. And if people really want to get into numbers, I'd encourage you to do that. And secondly, go to our website, which is fightchronicdisease.org.
Okay. Dr. Thorpe, anything else you want to bring up we might not have talked about?
No, I just want to make sure that people focus on the benefits of weight loss and the benefits of these lifestyle change programs. A lot of it's just awareness. I encourage people to look up the diabetes prevention program for people who are work with a large employer. Maybe call your benefits office to see what type of program like that they may have available as a covered benefit. And certainly for seniors, I would encourage seniors who are eligible to enroll in the program. It's a program that's effective. Unfortunately, I don't think there's enough knowledge that it exists, but I would encourage people to look very closely into that, both workers and Medicare patients.
And that's kind of what we're here for, to put that knowledge out there, let people know that this is an option to them.
Absolutely.
Dr. Kenneth Thorpe, chairman of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, appreciate you joining us here on Special Edition.
Well, thanks for having me. Have a terrific day.
Coming up next on Special Edition, Nancy and Jason from the WILK Morning News speak with Bob Durkin from the Greater Scranton Chamber of Commerce about the local business community update. It's all coming up when Special Edition continues.
All right, for the first time in 2025, Bob Durkin, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
We're going to be talking about Bob's to-do list, things involving the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
And your role as CEO/president.
Yeah.
Bob, fill in the blank. I believe 2025 will be the year that blank happens.
The first one is, what is going to become of CHS, Community Health Services Hospitals in Scranton? That's the biggest issue, really, that's affecting Scranton, Lackawanna County, and a lot of northeastern Pennsylvania. The interesting thing is that the conversations of the CHS hospitals that include Wilkes-Barre General, Regional, and Moses Taylor right now are really focused exclusively on the Scranton hospitals, because it seems that CHS has made the determination that they do make money at Wilkes-Barre General, so that they're not necessarily aggressively looking to get out of that or sell it. The biggest concern, of course, is not so much them selling it in Scranton, Regional, and Moses, is the prospect of them shutting them down.
This is a complex
situation. Yes, incredibly complex.
2025, just like the rest of these years, all 12 months, we had a lot of time to get these things done.
Yeah.
And these are so important, they have to get done.
That's
the big thing is shutting them down would just be terrible.
Absolutely. I mean, bad for the community, bad for the business community, bad for everybody. I mean, literally risk to health.
Yeah.
And so as a Chamber of Commerce, you might look at that and say, well, why is that a chamber thing? Well, it's everybody's concern. So this is all hands on deck. Here's the good news. There's a great deal of confidence from the governor's office that a deal is going to be struck. There are conversations with multiple providers, Geisinger, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Thomas Jefferson, Lehigh Valley, and I think some others, who are at least being brought to the table. We're hoping we're going to get over the first hurdle sometime in the next couple of months at the latest.
Is this process like a college football coach going out recruiting? Like, you're bringing them in. They may say, I'm not interested, but come see the campus. Come see the area.
Yeah, in a sense, except that the assets on the other end here are very limited. This is antiquated facilities, and frankly, the current owners have not maintained them.
Is it safe to say that we have two, they were separate hospitals, bought and brought into one group?
Yep.
That we may end up with just one hospital out of those two?
That's certainly possible. That's part of the conversation right now. In the last year or two, Moses Taylor and Regional, former Mercy, were actually brought in under a single license.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be historically, they were two separate hospitals. And even for most of the time that CHS has owned them, which is, I think, 11, 12 years at this point, they were separate hospitals. But they were ultimately recently brought under one license. So the question of which if either of the facilities would be maintained in the long run, that's one of the things that's on the table. So again, come back to the chamber perspective. What's our role here? We have reached out to the players, the elected officials and essentially said, we know you have the primary role here, particularly the governor's office, but there are going to be some other things that you may need, some resources, talent that you want to bring to the table. And we have made the offer, bring the talent to the table and we'll take care of it. You know, someone has to pay for it, we'll pay for it.
Wow.
That's how important it is. Beyond that, somebody is going to be selected. Once some entity is going to step up, well, there's going to be a heck of a lot of different issues that will surface. As it is, for example, it isn't just that CHS owns the former Mercy Hospital and Moses Taylor. They own basically two square blocks because they bought all the properties years back with the idea of making a physical connection between the two hospitals. And so, you know, because of our development arm, Scranton Lackawanna Industrial Building Company, SLIPCO, you know, we have a capacity to be able to assist in that regard. So today we made that offer to these players.
Oh, wow.
And we will make that offer to whoever it is that takes this over. Look, I'm not anxious to have to do the development on this thing, but someone's going to have to. And if it doesn't emerge through market circumstances, which is to say either the entity that's going to run the hospital or perhaps other third parties, as we've seen that we have so many of them now throughout northeastern Pennsylvania, individuals and small companies that are buying up and developing lands. Look, if that happens organically, terrific. But if it doesn't, we're going to be the safety net.
As we're doing this segment, it's January. What month in this year do you start sweating going, we got to get this done? It's getting like, how long you let this drag out?
Jason, I'll tell you what, we were sweating last month because CHS had made the pronouncement that they were prepared to announce the closing of the hospitals in early December.
Okay, so the sweating has begun. That explains the very wet jacket he's wearing.
No, the good news is that the governor's office has reported to us that that things have settled down and that CHS is being very cooperative with the administration. So that's number one. So CHS resolving that healthcare issue is the number one issue for us in 2025.
So again, filling in the blank here with Bob Durkin, President, CEO of the Greater Scranton Chamber of Commerce. I believe 2025 will be the year that blank happens. Number two.
Well, under the subject of infrastructure, I believe that Amtrak is going to be resolved this year. There's no question it will be resolved one way or another, and I feel confident it's going to be resolved in favor of creating that connection between Scranton and Midtown New York City, because the Amtrak project right now has made it to the second phase, which is a review by the Federal Railroad Administration. So far we've had Amtrak do a study, we've had the Railroad Administration do a study. Each of those entities have come back and said, this is a viable project, this is a valuable project for northeastern Pennsylvania.
Are we concerned, though, with the new administration?
I would say this, and Jason and I were talking about this before we started, there's always the threat of a political play on this in some form or fashion, but I'm going to go into this, and we're going into this as a chamber with a great degree of optimism of saying, look, things are going to be judged on their merits. And if they are, that objective approach on this tells us that this is a project that is worth doing. I think we've cited this before. The Amtrak numbers were projecting $84 million a year in economic impact from this rail. A separate study done by the Pocono Mountain Visitors Bureau that spoke to the issue of outdoor recreational activities, not just in the Pocono Mountains' normal footprint, but outside to include Lackawanna, Luzerne, and Wyoming counties. We're talking about the potential for $100 million worth of economic impact if that train is brought here. Because, not to go too deep into the weeds of a particular study, but they essentially reviewed households all over the city of New York and all the boroughs of New York, northern Jersey, and identified the incredible percentage of individuals there who are engaged in outdoor activities, biking, hiking, running, canoeing, fishing, hunting. And the prospect of them being able to get an easy connection from Manhattan to northeastern Pennsylvania has a potential for tremendous economic impact all across northeastern Pennsylvania. So we feel very strongly in our chamber board and, frankly, all of our affiliated organizations, and there are eight of us, eight different companies under the chamber, all have passed resolutions supporting the idea of the Amtrak train.
Have you guys had conversations with some of the newly elected folks, including Rob Bresnahan, who has taken the place of a Matt Cartwright? Have you guys have conversations about that?
Yeah, I would say this. We've had a great start to this relationship. We have met with Congressman Bresnahan now, I think, three or four times, including one specifically in partnership with the Pocono Mountain Visitors Bureau on the issue of Amtrak. We at the chamber, we brought our entire team down to his Pittston office. This is all before he was even sworn in, and did a briefing for him. He's been incredibly receptive to a whole host of topics and issues that that we've brought to the table from the business community's perspective, and on the, specifically on the Amtrak issue, I won't and can't speak for the congressman, but I will say that he has been open to understanding what the issues are. He has posed some important questions that he brought to the table, and I know that the team, particularly the Larry Malsky from the Railroad Authority, has very solid, concise, and clear answers to those questions. So one of the things that we need to do as a chamber, and perhaps on the, with the, working with the regional chambers, both on the CHS situation and with Amtrak, is we've got to get out in front of any of these questions. People that talk about the potential security issues of the train, honestly, I can't wait to get that information out there for everybody to see and read, because an Amtrak train has incredible security on the front end, on the train itself, and on the back end, everything from drug-sniffing dogs to basically a police force that's on the train. So some of the stuff that people have tossed out there, and I know we've all heard it, you know, it's important. And I don't dismiss people's initial concerns, but now we have good information. So it's up to us, it's up to the chamber, and it's up to the other partners to get that information out there to the public. And that's going to be critical for the Amtrak project to advance in 2025.
That's one of those big challenges, because there are so many people. I wish people would say things like, I worry about what could happen if this goes in. Whereas we don't hear that much. We get people saying this: I'm going to tell you why you need to be afraid, because this is going to happen, as if it's fact that it hasn't happened yet. It's a slight different, because you can tell someone who's a little concerned, say, well, this probably won't happen because of this. But we understand.
Right. Yeah. You know,
it's mindset.
I never think that people who have, you know, whether they're whatever the basis of their opinions may be, even if they're non-factual, I think it's always better you just address those with facts.
Yeah.
If they understand and receive the facts in the right way, terrific. And if they don't, there's nothing you can do about that.
I had a quick chat with someone who said one of the reasons they thought this was not going to work was that, what, are people just going to go there and work, and how they're going to spend their whole salary on the train back and forth? And I was like, no, talk to people who work in New York. The companies pay for your travel.
Yeah, it's just,
or they pay well enough to be able to pay for your travel.
Right. So it's not like,
look, there's a lot of naysayers when there are a lot of things that are being built or done in the area. And yet we have some really great things that started off with a lot of controversy and a lot of complaints.
Exactly. In a previous conversation we've had, remember, we went over a whole host of things. Right. Think about arena, yes or no. Yeah. It went down to the wire. And how valuable has the arena been?
Right.
Think about Montage and baseball and all the different things that have, the public investment that's been put in the Casey Highway.
Nancy and I mean, there's a couple.
Really, I can't remember what the final vote was on the arena, but it was darn close.
It really was.
Yeah,
it was very close, a handful of votes. Yeah. All right, so we're on to number three.
There you go.
Number three. I should have come up with a song.
Okay.
So the third one, and we talked about this again before we started, it maybe is not as quite as concrete as talking about the hospitals or Amtrak, but in 2025, the preeminent issue, not just for this Chamber of Commerce, but I'm going to say for all of the chambers in the region, and in fact, for so many other players, nonprofits, government, like, workforce is the issue. And let me draw it down to a much more concrete fashion. We already have seen outstanding work by a variety of the higher educational institutions. So LCCC, it's always been their bailiwick to be connecting the educational experience to actual jobs, actual work that's taking place or available here in northeastern Pennsylvania. Likewise, Lackawanna College does a great job there, and they've picked up their game as well. Johnson College the same way. So what I mean by this is, it isn't just an esoteric educational experience. It isn't an ivory tower education where you just go and get a particular degree and then you figure out what you're going to do. These are institutions, and in fact, I would say that almost all of the higher educational institutions are tacking in this direction. I think of the University of Scranton, where they're building their Center for Workforce Development. That's very concrete. It's a connection to real jobs, training for real specific jobs that are available here in northeastern Pennsylvania. But I don't want to emphasize the higher ed, because I think that the market has driven them in that direction. What I believe is critically important, and where we're going to put a great deal of emphasis in 2025, is in our connections to primary and secondary educations. I would say this unabashedly: every single school district in northeastern Pennsylvania has to take very seriously, as a part of their curriculum, the connection of their students to the real jobs, A, to make them aware that jobs exist, B, to tell them what it is required for those jobs, and, you know, C, to make connections with their families or their other decision makers that are part of this, so that people can capture and understand there are fantastic jobs, great many jobs throughout Northeastern Pennsylvania. We've had this conversation on the air before as well. You can't name a topic. You can't name a job sector where there are not an abundance of jobs in Northeastern Pennsylvania, be they healthcare or engineering, you know, higher end technology. Those jobs are here and they are growing. And some of the other work of our chamber and CANDU and other chambers of commerce and economic development organizations and Miracle, we're bringing these jobs here.
Right.
And we just need to make sure that we're connecting. So 2025, I think, has a tremendous important undercurrent of how do we get out and connect with the schools.
What you're talking about isn't just, here, we're going to tell you the skills you need to get a job like this. It's, here are the skills, specific skills, and things you need to know to get a job specifically with them, right?
Or to even start working in a field that they may want to work in. And it's so much better if they have their hands on and they see it and experience it and know what it means.
And then, you know, the offshoots from that are internships, apprenticeships, educational experiences, and connecting the businesses into the schools. Well, no, we do a lot of that now. In fact, we have our workforce summit that's coming up on March 20th at the Radisson Lackawanna Station. And the emphasis for the last few years, and most notably for this year, has not just been a job fair where you open the doors and expect people to walk in. Yes, we'll have that. But more so, the emphasis here is to bring students in. So we're literally connecting with school districts and bringing students in to meet with the representatives of the various industries that are spread across Northeastern Pennsylvania. One-on-one opportunities, high school students.
Yeah, and it's wild because when I was younger, so many more high school students had jobs than you see now today.
Yeah.
Some will go all the way through college before they may actually have, you know, a pretty steady job that they do.
Yeah, I mean, and not only is that a reflection of or building a, you know, work ethic, but it's for many people, you know, how about maybe people in radio, right?
It's not for everybody.
Well, you know, we joked about it before. It's like, I don't know of anybody who, you know, in grade school said, boy, I hope I can work for a chamber of commerce. But I do think there are people that would say they'd like to work in radio.
But even through the years, as a manager here at the radio station, we get nowhere near the applicants from college students looking for work that we used to get. Whether we're not even talking an internship where you're unpaid, you know, paid internships, we do not see people applying like they used to.
Yeah. And again, that goes back to what I said before about making sure that we're connecting back to the families. So, you know, think about it. The parents are going to be a big part of the decision making and what's going to happen with their children. And it's got to be beyond extracurriculars, right? It's got to be about their education. It's got to be about preparing them for what happens when they graduate, either from high school or later from higher ed.
Wouldn't it be something if they put as much energy into it as you would with sports? Not to knock sports, but it seems like most of the energy goes into let's do travel sports. And then when the sports are done, you got to worry about getting in the real world.
Yeah. It is interesting, too, because even though people have come to the revelation that, well, I'm probably not going pro. People will be like, oh, you play baseball. You think you'll go pro? You never hear anyone go, I hear you're good at math. You think you're going to be an engineer? What's your career path? Why don't we talk about stuff like that? It's almost like I'm at a point in my life, I don't want to talk about a will because I don't want to think about my ultimate demise eventually. And younger people don't want to think about their career. They just want to worry about what I'm going to do that's fun next.
Yeah. Which,
what's wrong with people?
Well, you have certain groups. So, for example, we have through our Leadership Lackawanna program, Tomorrow's Leaders Today. These are high school juniors. And we actually just expanded the program this year. Normally, we would have about 40 students in there, but a competitive process to get TLT, as we call it, usually out of 80 to 100 applicants. So what we did was we ramped it up. I think we have 82 to 84 in this year's class. These are achievers. These are the folks, the young people who are going, they're taking advanced placement classes. They are going on to higher education without whether they're a part of our program or not. We believe they gain value from being a part of this program. The bigger challenge is individuals who maybe are not obvious.
Yeah.
And when I mentioned our workforce summit, one of the things that we've done with that is we've gone to the schools and we have said, we don't want you sending us your, you know, advanced placement students. We want you to look in your classrooms, talk to your teachers, look at those diamonds in the rough. you know, and it might be family circumstances, or in some cases, you know, and again, we talked about this off air before, there could be some modest learning disability, but not a disability that would prohibit these people from becoming productive members of society.
Regular education maybe doesn't fit perfectly to their mold.
How many very successful people do you hear from who also didn't have it easy, didn't have those high grades, and yet they had a great work ethic. They had, you know, they were persevered nonetheless.
Yeah. And so we're trying to, you know, spread this out. We're trying to make sure that we're going not to the low hanging fruit of to bring in all of the bright kids, the A students. No, let's talk about how we connect with others, because we all know this. It doesn't, as you just implied there, Nancy, it doesn't necessarily mean that these aren't bright young people. It's just not, maybe the traditional educational experience is not one that's capturing their strengths.
Coming up next on Special Edition, I'll feature an encore of my interview with Brad Pfeiffer about National Dog Training Month, the month of January, and how best to train your dog. It's all coming up when Special Edition continues. This is Special Edition. I'm Brian Hughes. My guest is Brad Pfeiffer, Executive Director of the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers. That's because January is National Train Your Dog Month. Good morning, sir.
Hi, how are you?
It's great. It's always great to talk about dogs, one of my favorite animals in the whole wide world. Why January for National Train Your Dog Month, if I may ask?
Well, January is, you know, traditionally the month where we all kind of take stock of our goals for the coming year. And so the dog training industry chose January as an opportunity to highlight the need for dog owners to take stock of their dog's behavior and put in some effort to fixing any undesired behavior problems that we may have.
What seems to be the biggest undesirable behavior method? Because I'm sure dogs probably don't like a lot of our behaviors either, but...
I'm sure dogs are really frustrated by a lot of the things that we do. But for most dog owners, it's the normal nuisance behaviors. We want our dogs to come when called more readily. We want our dogs to sit for attention rather than jumping up. We want our dogs to play in the backyard without digging.
What seems to be the most effective method when it comes to training dogs?
Positive reinforcement. We know through both practical application and research that, you know, dogs do best when we are focused on teaching them what we want them to do and reinforcing them for desired behavior patterns. It makes them like us more. It makes them feel more comfortable. It makes them feel more safe, and it builds our relationship with them.
That seems like the best way. It's kind of a common sense thing. Now, I remember back in the 80s, there was the Woodhouse method, and that was kind of a fad for a while. Is that still being utilized, or has that gone the way of the pet rock and other things?
Dog training, like many other things in life, have evolved, and most trainers today are using positive reinforcement dog training methods to build behavior. You know, in the 80s, when I was growing up, I rode in the back of a truck without any helmet on, and we didn't wear our seatbelts. So, you know, we grow and evolve.
Good times. I miss those days sometimes. This is Special Edition. My guest, Brad Pfeiffer, Executive Director of the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers. I guess with rescue dogs, it's just a matter of how long it takes them to get used to being in an actual home rather than being in a shelter. So that's got to be more difficult than, say, if you get a puppy from either a friend or, you know, situation like that. Right? Given a rescue dog may have been in a shelter for a long time, so they know of no other way. So it's got to be difficult getting them acclimated to an actual home setting.
You know, most dogs, though, are really adaptable and resilient. That's one of the reasons that, you know, they do so well in homes and that we enjoy them so much. Again, they're friendly, they're human-oriented, they're adaptable, they're resilient. So certainly, it's going to take a dog time to acclimate to a new environment or get to know people.
This is Special Edition. I'm Brian Hughes. My guest is Brad Pfeiffer, Executive Director of the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers, talking about the best ways of training your dog. How long does it normally take? I'm sure it's probably different for some breeds as opposed to others, but what would be the average time to get a dog trained to your liking?
Some of that is going to depend on expectations, right? For a dog to learn just foundation skills like sit, come down, stay, 3 weeks would be a realistic expectation for them to learn the concepts. It may take much longer to build fluency where the dog is able to do those skills or respond to those skills under a variety of circumstances. And some of it also comes down to maturity. A six-month-old dog is going to have a different level of reliability or behavior compared to a three-year-old dog.
I think one of the things, too, when you're training a dog, it has to be tone of voice. Because if you're angry all the time, that's going to make the dog a bit jittery, a bit nervous. You know, just a natural voice, just talking to him like you would talk to a child, I would think.
A natural, calm, confident tone of voice. You know, Sophie sit, Sophie come, lie down. That should totally get the job done. Dogs do understand tones sometimes. And so a higher pitched tone, like, you know, good girl, that can get a dog excited. A lower tone may get the dog to feel a little insecure or threatened. So I think you're exactly right. Even confident, calm tones are a great way of communicating with your dog.
This is Special Edition. Guest this morning, Brad Pfeiffer, Executive Director for the Certification Council of Professional Dog Trainers. If you got a new puppy for Christmas and you're just trying to get the puppy broken in, make sure you train it well so you don't have too many accidents in the house, and making sure they go out. Again, just to reiterate, as far as leash walking, if a puppy's not used to that, what's the average amount of time it would take in, you know, days or possibly weeks to get them acclimated to that?
A puppy could learn to walk comfortably on a leash within a few days. A certified professional dog trainer can help owners learn the process that is best for their individual puppy. But, you know, most dogs, again, you attach a leash to their collar, they drag it around the house a little bit, you pick it up and have them follow you from room to room, and they're going to get used to that process. And some puppies who are just kind of bold and confident may acclimate much more quickly.
Now, the other one would be if you have company over, getting the dog to make sure they behave around company and don't invade their very personal space, so to speak, even though that guest may be sitting on their part of the couch. So what's how long does that usually take? Or is it just one of those things where if they're used to people coming over, they adapt to it?
All training is a process. And that process entails ensuring that our dog's physical needs are met, that they're well exercised, ensuring that we as owners and caretakers are spending the time to train the dog on how to behave. So when you're talking about guests coming over, it's important to make sure that that the dog has been well exercised before company arrives. And if the owners are not able or kind of able to focus on the dog in the moment, that we should put the puppy or the young dog in a crate or in an X pen. So that way they're not rehearsing behaviors that we are trying to resolve. And then when we have the time to incorporate training, that we walk up to new guests with the dogs on a leash and collar and teach them to sit for attention or lie down next to us while we're talking with company, versus maybe having them free and they're running up and jumping on someone or, you know, nudging them for attention. All of us as dog owners really need to think about, what do we want our dog to do? When guests come to my house, how do I want my dog to behave? And we need to spend the time proactively training those skills, usually with a leash and collar or a body harness and collar. And then if we have a situation where our dog is just uncomfortable with guests coming over to the home, working with a certified professional dog trainer can help the owner learn how to manage their dog or help them acclimate to what might be an unsafe situation from the dog's perspective.
Brian, anything else you want to discuss that we might not have brought up regarding the dog training process?
I think it's important just to focus to remind everyone that we want to focus on exercising our dogs well, managing them to prevent behavior problems, and working with certified professional trainers to help the owners learn how to train their dogs effectively, humanely, and so that way none of us are frustrated, the dogs, ourselves.
Brad, where can we find out more information regarding dog training?
Anyone can visit our website. It's ccpdt.org. To learn more about how to find a dog trainer in your area. We also have a website for dog owners called fetchtheanswer.com. That's fetchtheanswer.com. And there is a trainer directory as well as informational training sheets for how to manage and begin training at your house until you can get a dog trainer into your home.
Okay, outstanding. Someday we'll have to talk about cats, but then they're really the masters of the house anyway. They're the ones training us. So that one's above my pay grade. Whole nother conversation. Brad Pfeiffer, Executive Director of the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers. Appreciate you joining us here on Special Edition.
Thank you so much.
Are you passionate about serving your community? Join the National Health Corps Community Health Fellowship to advance public health in Northeast PA. You'll receive community health worker training, a living stipend, benefits, plus the opportunity to earn an educational grant and become a certified community health worker. With the Community Health Fellowship, you can earn while you learn, serve, and train your way to a new career. To apply and learn more, go to www.nationalhealthcorps.org/NEPA.
How do you give hope to a child in the foster care system? It starts with your heart. That tug you feel on yours when you hear that children are waiting for a stable, loving voice to speak up for their best interests. And then it becomes your time. What started out as a feeling that maybe you could make a difference becomes the difference. Change a child's story. There is a child waiting for a volunteer like you.
Learn how you can help at LackawannaCountyCASA.org.
Thank you for joining us this week on Special Edition. Special Edition is a weekly public affairs presentation of Odyssey Wilkes-Barre. I'm Brian Hughes. Thanks again for listening.